Welcome back to Case of the Sunday Scaries. I'm Elise.
And I'm Annie.
And
all we can do is just laugh at this point.
We said last episode that we might have jinxed ourselves talking about doing video during Mercury retrograde, which is supposed to cause all these technical disadvantages. Well, guys, we are recording this remotely yet again because I got influenza A. I came down with it on Tuesday and thankfully today broke my fever. So we have put off recording this because I sounded not human for a few days.
No, a little grudgy. Like the Grudge movie. Like,
hello.
Yeah, it was rough. I'm going to talk about a case today where I might actually wish this upon this person. But other than that, influenza is no joke. I will no longer be using like, oh, I got the stomach flu, when really that's not the flu. Like the actual flu, it just sucks. And it has sucked the life out of me this week. But we are back. We are recording. It is not going to be on video, unfortunately, because I don't want to share my cooties with her and her new little one in her tummy. So she is staying very far away from me. And we will just try our best another time.
We will. It's a new year. I think Mercury retrogrades out of its funk in like 2 weeks, which will give us some time. But I love whenever I texted you this morning, I'm like, are we looking cute? And you're like, I'm barely surviving at this point. Roger that.
Yeah, I have a heat pack wrapped around my waist. I got my blankie. I got some throat coat tea, and we are rocking this out. Today, we're going to be continuing our series about intimate partner abuse with a focus on stalking and harassment. As you guys know, in the first episode, I shared part of my story about my ex-fiance, and I have to say, you guys, I was blown away by how many people privately wrote me and trusted me with their stories and their shared experiences. Obviously, I consider this a huge privilege to be trusted with that information. And while I was very honored, it was also so concerning to me just how many people had similar stories to mine. I obviously got out of that relationship, and the road to recovery has been challenging at times. I think what surprised me the most about that episode, and even when discussing it prior with you, Annie, is that while I've done a lot of therapy and I tend to think I'm quote unquote over it, and it's been so many years, like 13 years, it was so shocking to me how my body seemed to go back into fight or flight response just by talking about it and remembering these moments. I was sweating and under the table, my feet were going a mile a minute, bouncing against the chair legs.
I can attest to this because I remember we were recording that in the studio and just your body language. And then mine kind of mimicked yours because it was a stressful situation. I could tell it was uncomfortable, but I am proud of you and I am excited for today's episode. I don't know if excited is the right word. I'm eager to hear about it.
I get what you meant. But it's clear that it's something that myself and so many others are going to carry with them as part of their story for a long time. But in researching this series, one thing was very clear to me. I am one of the lucky ones. I wanted to see just how prevalent this was, and according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, 1 in 7 women and 1 in 18 men have been stalked by an intimate partner during their lifetime to the point in which they felt very fearful or believed that themselves or someone close to them would be harmed or killed.
That is an alarming statistic. I knew the numbers were high. But oh my gosh.
I suspect that that number is probably actually higher in men. There's a stigma when men come forward, right? That there shouldn't be, but there is in our society. You know, men are tough and rough and no woman, you know, is going to one-up me. I hate that for them because it makes men not comfortable to come forward. So I imagine it's actually probably higher than 1 in 18 men. These numbers are obviously inexcusable. Between understanding just how many men and women are victims of this type of abuse and then having you guys all share your stories with me, I was more determined than ever to continue with this series so that hopefully, in some small way, perhaps it can make others aware of just how dangerous this type of abuse is. And perhaps if someone out there is listening who is currently in this type of high control, harassment, stalking type relationship, you might recognize some of these behaviors and find a way out.
And I think just know that you're not alone and there is support out there. There is help. I've never been in that situation. I'm sure it's terrifying, but we're sending you our love and we will also link some good resources for you.
Absolutely.
We'll do that on the gram and then probably in this episode.
Today's case is what inspired me to do this series originally, because while Molly's case is beyond tragic, I think it really demonstrates not only all the red flags to be aware of when dating, but also shows that just because someone isn't physically assaulted during the course of a relationship doesn't mean that it's not an abusive relationship, and reporting should be taken just as seriously. Obviously, you guys, huge trigger warning with this series. In every episode, we are going to be discussing very heavily domestic abuse, stalking, and harassment. Molly McLaren was born in Kent, which is part of the United Kingdom, and was a stunning young woman. I mean, striking.
Truly beautiful. Also, I mean, she has an accent. I feel like that makes people so much more attractive whenever they talk like this and they're just from the UK.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm not even going to try to do an accent because I'm just trying to get out words. So I'm going to leave that to you. Feel free to talk like that for the rest of the episode.
I've gotcha. No worries.
Unfortunately, though, as a teen and into her young adult years, Molly developed disordered eating and bulimia. And unfortunately, she also really struggled with anxiety. But Molly, not one to let this get her down, she decided to take action. She got the help she needed and decided to use her experience with disordered eating to help others and pursued a career in fitness, studying nutrition at the University of Kent. In a True Crime Central documentary about this case, it's clear that Molly was adored. It's a horrible TikTok that I sent you, Annie. But it seems like this is true. This is how we always start out these cases, of describing these beautiful people with so much life ahead of them. And it's just like, why does this have to happen to them?
Yeah, I think the TikTok was like, you never want to be described as someone who lights up a room, because you're right. The people who have these bigger than life personalities, they're beautiful inside and out. They're always the center of our stories.
Well, Molly obviously was adored, and she quickly made a great group of girlfriends. One of her teachers gushed about her in the documentary, saying that it seemed like everyone on campus took notice of Molly since Freshers Week. I had no idea what Freshers Week meant.
No, is it like the kickoff week of college? What do we call it? Welcome Week.
Very, very similar. They don't necessarily have classes. It's a week-long event at the beginning of the school year, where they have tons of social events. It's basically a way to make new students feel comfortable in their surroundings and give them a chance to make friends.
I love that.
Me too.
So fun.
I want to go to Freshers Week.
Although, let's go.
I don't want to hang out with people that age, actually.
True.
I'd probably be a little annoyed by day one. Her teacher said Molly was so bouncy and lively and always walked into a room with a big smile on her face. A smile one of her friends said was always very heavily caffeine fueled, which, same, Molly, especially right now, same. She was really focused on her schooling and friends, but in her desire to help others, began a blog about nutrition and fitness in hopes of inspiring others to overcome their trials too. I want to read you an excerpt from her last entry, which I think really shows how Molly modeled her life and her mindset. Keep in mind, this girl has overcome a lot in her very young age. She wrote, "I am a realist and accept that there are many horrible things that we have to deal with in life that are unavoidable and uncontrollable. But what if we took more control over the things that we have the chance to? If we put in 100%, I believe we can achieve and radiate positivity. I'm a firm believer that for many things, we get back what we put in. Great things can happen to us. We can outweigh the bad if we stop making our own excuses and instead make changes, changes that might scare us, but changes that we want."
I love that mindset. Was this entry on her online blog? Was it in a journal?
This was her last entry to her blog. So Molly's crushing it, right? She's an honor student, has a great friend group, but college is also a time to explore your romantic life a little bit. Her friend said that Molly didn't have a lot of dating experience, and unlike many people her age who wanted to date someone, maybe just for the comfort of it in a new environment, or let's be honest, date someone when your parents aren't, you know, under the same roof.
Oh,
hint,
yes.
Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
A-O to that.
But Molly was only really interested in dating someone who she could see a serious future with. That's not always the case with someone her age. I mean, she had really outlined her goals and was going towards them.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a very mature mindset. I'm not going to mess around with all these little new freshman boys. Like, I want someone who I see a future with, who I can see potentially one day being my partner forever.
Yeah, I wanted to flirt with everyone at that age. I was just wanting
attention.
I did
flirt with everyone at that age.
Well, Molly obviously was very active online, posting her workout videos, her blogs, updating Facebook and Instagram constantly, as we all do. So it's not a giant surprise that she would also give online dating a try. She downloaded Tinder and began swiping. And at the end of the college year, with summer right around the corner, she matched with Joshua Stimson, who lived about 9 miles away from her. And in July, she sent her first message to her new match. Did you ever like date during the time of online dating, or have you just been with your hubby forever?
I am a serial monogamous. I don't like being single. So I met Derek at a bar. Should have been home. I was pretty lit. But then he walked up and he's like, "You want to go swing dancing?" And then it was love at first sight. Truly it was. I have a great catch. At least I know you've met him before. But
yeah, he's pretty amazing.
You've online dated, right? I feel like we talked about this.
I've swiped. I've gone on a couple dates prior to being on the show. I've swiped, to be honest. I have not gone on a date from any of those things in quite some time. It just makes me nervous, especially after doing this podcast. I'm just overly hyper aware, I feel like.
So many horror stories from online dating, but also a lot of success stories as well.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of my friends have met their partners through online
dating. I love taking my friends' phones and swiping on their behalf. I'm like, nope, nope, nope. He's kind of in your league, but nope, nope, nope. They're like, "I don't have any matches anymore, Annie. Ran them all out."
Well, if I wasn't nervous before, this one will certainly make me not want to be on there swiping. Plus, my ADD, now speaking of ADD, we're really going on a tangent here. My ADD does not allow me. I don't think I'm a person that's meant to have so many options, because I'm like, I just get distracted. Like, who's who? What were they about? What did their profile say? I just get annoyed by it. Mm-hmm. So then I end up deleting it before I ever actually, you know, meet anyone.
That's like the most Elise thing ever.
Yeah. But back to the story. Molly was really quick to share her life online, but she was a bit more reserved with meeting Josh in person, as she should be. And they actually chatted for a few months before ever meeting in November of 2016. They really hit it off. And Molly seemed pretty happy at first, telling her friends that she had met someone. And soon after their first in-person meeting, Josh became Molly's first serious boyfriend. Josh had confided in her about his struggles with mental health, and it seemed these two had a lot in common. They both had seemingly overcome a lot of the same things, and they also both had a passion for fitness. Annie, I sent you a picture of the two of them together. From the outside, they were a very striking couple.
Striking. That's the perfect word for them. So she has kind of longish, almost like a balayage, is that what you call it? Mm-hmm. Where it's like a little bit darker at the roots, blonde hair. Gorgeous blue eyes, perfect skin. And then, yeah, he's super cute too. Kind of like a nice thick head of dark hair, beautiful smile, very well-groomed eyebrows.
Yeah, he does. I noticed that as well. These two look like they belonged in a Crest ad.
Yeah, truly.
Well, Molly told her friends that she felt she could help Josh and that Josh could help her too. They really understood each other in a way that maybe others couldn't, who hadn't been through the same dark times and mental health struggles. So let's back it up. Who is Tinder Prince Charming? Josh had grown up mainly raised by his father after his parents divorced and indeed did struggle with depression, getting diagnosed at a really young age. But what Molly didn't know was Josh's history of romantic relationships. In 2013, just 3 years before Josh met Molly, the police had been alerted about his inappropriate behavior. Josh had gone on one date. I repeat, one date with a girl who I won't name because she's innocent in all this. And it seems that maybe she just wasn't that interested in pursuing it further, and Josh could not handle that. The blow to the ego. This is insane. After one date, he sent her harassing messages for months.
Oh, boy. I feel like whenever we talk about abusers, it always comes back to rejection or something they take really, really personal. And it sounds like that's what happened with Josh, where she was probably just like, "Hey, we're not a good vibe.
Yeah.
This isn't a good fit." And he takes
it
so personal.
As you're supposed to. That's the whole point of dating. You get to know each other. You're like, "Oh, you're a great person, but you're not for me."
Exactly.
And that should be the end of the conversation. But it wasn't in this case. The family finally reached out to police after all four of her car tires had been slashed. And Josh had written her a text saying, quote, "in the back."
Oh, that's ominous.
Obviously implying that he was at her home. The police officer who responded to this report texted Josh and left a voicemail on his phone telling him to stop. It seemed to put a halt to his messaging, except when she went on vacation and he found out about it, he wrote her, quote, "I'm going to fly out and drown you," and following it with, "if you ever touch my family, I'll stab you." This girl had never even met his family. She didn't know what he was talking about.
These are very dark thoughts. And imagine getting that from one date.
Seriously. I'm going to be interjecting in a way that I don't normally do when I'm telling these cases. And I hope you guys kind of bear with me because I'm going to be jumping to my thoughts and back to the case throughout this. But I think it's important too because I want to recognize and break down not just the shock of someone behaving this way, but the implication behind his words. We might read that, and obviously Annie and I are both going like, what the heck? You went on one date. We're repulsed by it. But if they aren't communicating anymore, it means that Joshua was so obsessive after only going on one date with this girl that months later, he's still keeping tabs on her. How did he even know she was on vacation? It's not just the texts that are alarming. It's that he is keeping tabs on her, most likely through social media, to see what she's doing, where she is, and who she's with. In May 2016, just 2 months before he would start talking online with Molly, he harassed another woman he had a brief relationship with, even spitting in her face. And I swear to God, I think most people who know me know I am not a violent person. I can cut you with words, but my fists are not going up. But there is something so condescending about spitting on someone that I think I would lose my mind.
Agree. It is the most disrespectful thing I think someone can do. Like, who gives you the say to put your nasty saliva all over someone else? But this guy is real. I'm really getting turned off by him. I had already kind of an odd feeling about him knowing he was going to be.
What kind of podcast we host.
Right. But like, you see him and he looks completely normal. Not that they always don't, because we always say they do. But hearing these things that he's doing is just, it's disgusting.
Well, she told him if he ever showed up unannounced to her apartment again, she would contact the police. However, the police were never notified of this harassment, and it seemed like it did stop. But I think it's more reasonable to think that he stopped harassing her because his attention had shifted to someone else so soon after. And unfortunately, this person was Molly. So Molly and Josh have been dating for a few months, and she's back at school after the holidays, Christmas, New Year's, you know, back at it. And she feels like it's finally time to introduce Josh to her inner circle of friends. When one of Molly's closest friends, Amelia, met Josh, she noticed right away that he was a little bit standoffish. But she figured, you know, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's a little bit shy or just uncomfortable around like such a close group of girlfriends, which makes sense.
It does. It can always be a little bit intimidating whenever you're the one newbie and being introduced. Like, you want to make a really good first impression. You obviously like this person. Friends are our harshest critics, as they should be.
Right.
We love a good girl group.
Well, and you have all the inside jokes that you don't know what the heck they're talking about. So she wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. But immediately after leaving that initial meeting, Molly decided to confide in her friend that Josh had begun texting her disparaging things about Amelia. And here's where I'm going to interject again. Abusers, often their first step is isolating the person. It's a lot easier to control someone when you have them one-on-one. When I told my story, I mentioned how he started by creating this over-the-top boyfriend of the year image to my friends. But when that was not working anymore because he couldn't keep it up, he would constantly tell me things that would make me doubt my friends' intentions. I thought they were saying things that they weren't saying about me. And he would cause all sorts of public scenes that I told you guys about that would make people not really want to be around me. And it would be isolating me from people who probably would have pointed out, hey, something does not seem right here. My world got smaller and smaller, and you can see how quickly Josh went about doing the same thing. And I think, I'm trying to imagine, I was around the same age as her, but this wasn't my first relationship. And I think it would be even harder when this is your first real love. And it's also the person that you might feel is the only one that gets you. They have all these shared hardships with mental health. And I want you guys to really recognize through these stories that pattern of isolation.
I like that you brought up her first real kind of boyfriend, because she might have even been thinking, this is normal. It's how he's showing he cares about me. Like, he's just being concerned with who I'm hanging out with, you know?
Absolutely.
Maybe you don't really have those trigger moments of like, this is not good. Like we have now, because hindsight's always 20/20.
Right. Well, Molly's close friend Amy described in the documentary how soon after she met Josh, she noticed that he would often turn up unannounced, even when Molly, who again was a star student, told Josh that she needed to study or had homework. He would tell her that he needed to be there to support her, to keep her on track, which absolutely grinds my gears when I read that, because Molly was doing wonderfully before she met Josh. She had already overcome all of these obstacles that she faced with her eating, with her health, with her mental health, and her grades were great. She had a great friend group, and she was also using all of her struggles and putting effort in to help other people. Like, she's good, Josh. She's great, actually.
You want to support her? Send her a coffee gift card and say, like, keep crushing it. Let her get her little caffeine fix that we know she loves and leave her alone.
Yes, please leave her alone. Well, Molly is starting to feel downright overwhelmed. Her and Josh have been dating a few months. She obviously really likes him. She's saying that she loves him at this time, but he is always around. So she sends him a text saying, we can't be with each other 24/7. I feel really pressured. I think knowing his history, you can just about guess how that conversation went over. And I just want to point out, what she said was not confrontational. She's opening up to him and setting some boundaries. And we should all be allowed to have boundaries in a relationship.
Mic drop.
Come on, Josh. Well, Josh began talking so cruelly towards her. And Molly, even though she's a really strong girl, of course, when someone you care about is saying mean things about you or you're fighting with them, it obviously is going to bring you down. Josh was really using intimate knowledge that he had about her and her past to bring her down, texting all the time, always wanting to be together, showing up when he wasn't invited, and Molly had had enough and ended her relationship. Let's just do a little clap for Molly at 22 years old recognizing this.
Knowing her worth and knowing what she deserves. And that's, at a young age, that's really hard to put together. So good for her.
Of course, here's where that cycle of awful behavior followed by sweet and remorseful behavior begins. Josh is texting her that he's sorry, he will do anything for just another chance. He is begging and promising that things will change. And I'm actually going to interject here and just say I'm a words girl, so I can fall for people's words. But I want to just challenge you all that even if you're the one apologizing, if there's not action behind it to figure out why you're making those decisions, you cannot promise they will never happen again. And that's where I'm going to step off my little soapbox and go back into this. So this continues for a few weeks, and Molly believes maybe he is seeing the error of his ways, and she believes him, and she takes him back. Her friends said that they warned her not to, of course. But Molly almost seemed riddled with guilt that Josh was not doing well without her, which again makes my blood boil because this man has confided in her about his history of mental health. And while that obviously that's something that you have to take seriously, it's not something that should be used as a tool for manipulating someone else to get what you want or elicit an emotional response from someone. Like, he is picking at everything that she would be sensitive to get what he wants, which is her, all of the time.
He knows exactly what to say to her and where to hit her. He has the key to her emotions, and he's really fiddling with it.
Yeah, he knows what buttons to push. It just makes me mad. I can take this heating pad off because I'm getting a little sweaty over
here.
Your
fever be breaking, girl. Yeah, it's going away.
We should have just recorded this. I would have broke my fever a couple days ago. Well, almost immediately after getting back together, surprise, surprise, Josh must have forgotten the weeks he spent promising to change because once again, he's inviting himself everywhere Molly was going. Girls' night out, Josh is there. Studying for a test, keep in mind, he wasn't going to the same college as her, but he's still going to be there. Imagine, as the friends, how fed up you would be getting at this point. Your friend's boyfriend is constantly showing up everywhere. This was another tactic to isolate her. Even in a crowd, she was under his watch constantly. And I want to give credit to her friends. It seems like while they're annoyed, they kind of put up with it for Molly's sake. But you could see just how many people would want to stop inviting you to things if your boyfriend is going to be showing up all the time, acting standoffish, pulling you away to have these intense conversations, and overall just like dampening the vibes.
And like lurking in the corner, just like hovering there. I'm just getting the ick.
Yeah, you would get sick of it when you just want to let loose with your friend, have a, college girls' night out. I get it. And I'm glad that they didn't stop inviting her to things, but you can certainly understand how quickly it could be isolating when your friends are like, you know what? She's not going to dump this loser. We don't enjoy being around him. They can go do their own thing. In the spring of 2017, Molly decided, I'm sure with Josh's input, to give the relationship one last chance and go away on vacation together. Maybe if they were alone, just the two of them, they could really get back on solid ground. Is any of this sounding familiar to you yet?
Mm-hmm.
I keep pointing out these similarities between Molly's story and mine, not to divert focus from Molly at all. That is certainly not my intention. But because I want listeners to see the similarities in not just these two stories that have parallels, but these common traits in most, if not all, high control relationships. A pattern of isolating, emotional manipulation, the low lows followed by promises of change, and then big romantic gestures following it. I really want listeners to see these similarities, so hopefully they can notice these red flags in their own dating experience or be aware of them as their children, friends, or loved ones start a new relationship. Sadly, texts from Molly to her friends during this vacation were not reports of a fabulous trip. She was miserable, writing, "Thought the stuff with Josh would pass, but it's not. And this is the worst thing ever." Molly was convinced after this vacation that the relationship really needed to be done. But yet again, Josh manipulated the situation when they returned home. By June 17th, 2017, Molly is going out to celebrate her 23rd birthday, a night that should be spent laughing with those you love. And Molly and Josh had been arguing for weeks, basically since they left. Well, since they went on the vacation. The vacation was crap, and now everything has just been a mess since. But of course, he attended the birthday festivities and for a while even put on a happy face in front of her friends. But that soon would change, and while we don't know what was said between Molly and Josh that evening, it was enough for Molly to end their relationship right there in the middle of the nightclub.
Must have been something pretty heated. And this is almost exactly a year after they first started talking.
No. They started talking online in July. They didn't meet until November. So we're talking
like 9 months. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 8 months, something along those lines.
Things have escalated very quickly. Poor Molly.
Josh shouted, "She's finished with me," and stormed out. I imagine while they all thought Josh was a bit off, seeing him shouting at their friend and embarrassing their friend in the middle of a nightclub on her birthday was alarming. Molly was so fed up with the arguments over texts and social media that she ended up blocking Josh across all of her socials. And good for her. Josh clearly was upset. He can't keep harassing Molly privately through DMs and texts. So what's an asshole abusive boy to do?
Make a new account.
No, I actually thought he would do the same thing, but he just decides to go public with it all and starts posting about Molly on Facebook. This man would make posts alleging that Molly did cocaine and then would tag her family in these posts so they would see them. Now, keep in mind, Molly is excelling at school. She has overcome all of these obstacles, and online she's portraying and living up to, you know, of course she goes out with her friends, but otherwise she is portraying all of her health and fitness routine, and she's really putting a lot of focus into that. And he's trying to just hit her where it could have some serious consequences, not only with her family, but with school, with police, with like, it's just...
That's such a hard line that he just crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. He would talk about private parts of her life publicly, even sharing screenshots of their conversations that he had, which I am sure did not show his messages to her, but her very frustrated responses back to him. But that's just my speculation. But I think we all know it's probably true. Molly had spent all of this time and effort, and he's just trying to take everything that she's built away from her. Makes me very, 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 very upset. I told you that Molly had a really great inner circle, especially her girlfriends. And she did, because instead of feeding into this nonsense, which might have been tempting to do at that age, her family and friends followed her lead and blocked Josh on all social media platforms as well. But not to be outsmarted, Josh turns to the last way of contacting Molly he now has, which is the app WhatsApp. He was getting progressively more intense with his messaging, and sadly, Molly wrote to her friend, "Josh is getting so nasty. I'm scared he might hurt me. He knows my parents are going away for 2 weeks." Josh at this time makes a post of his own, simply writing, "There's more to come."
Oh, this guy needs to seek some kind of help, because I feel like this is a lot of inner turmoil he's going through, but that's no excuse. And just trying to put myself in Molly's shoes, the fact that she said she's afraid he's going to hurt her, he knows that her parents are going away, that just is a really scary feeling to have. You know, I bet she never felt truly comfortable and relaxed, even in her own home, because who knows if he's at the window staring in or right outside her house in his car.
Yeah, because he has a history of showing up unannounced. And you got to keep in mind, this is about the end of the school year. She's home, you know? So it would be very scary to think my parents are going away. I don't have anyone to protect me. But June 22nd, 2017, Molly takes action and prints out the screenshots of Josh's conversations with her. The posts he has made all about her and all these ridiculous speculations of, you know, what she's doing in her time. And with her mom by her side, she takes them all to the police. The police officer decided to phone Josh, ask him to take the post about Molly down. And here's where I'm getting back on my soapbox, because this pisses me off. This man is clearly harassing her, and this police officer calls him, and maybe that's a fine place to start. You know, scare him a little bit. Maybe for most people that would work. But I wondered if perhaps the UK didn't have restraining orders or protective orders like we do here. I obviously don't know their laws. So I started Googling, and correct me if I'm wrong, UK listeners. Yeah, because we actually have some. That's very exciting.
It is exciting. They probably hated my accent. So sorry, guys.
But in the UK, they have something called a non-molestation order, which is an odd choice of phrasing, but it is very similar to what we call a restraining order, and it's meant to protect and make sure that there is no in-person contact or contact through any means, really, from someone who has shown a pattern of abuse in a domestic relationship. And this is what pisses me off, because here's the thing. I understand needing to prove to a certain degree that this behavior has been going on for a while, that it's escalating. There needs to be proof to get a restraining order, right? I'm all for that. But the worst case scenario, absolute worst case scenario, that is maybe they grant one and the girl or guy who is doing the abusive behavior gets the hint and leaves them alone. They're just saying, don't talk to each other anymore.
And I mean, kudos to her for bringing in the police. I feel like she's done a lot of things right. She's let her friends and family know that this guy is scaring her. She goes to the police. Like, she's checking off the boxes of what you should be doing.
Yeah. And the thing that makes me mad, though, is yes, if they do this and they get a protective order or this, you know, non-molestation order, they really need to change the title, but it would be on their record as it should be. But it's not a crime. So it's not like you're, you know, deterring someone from, you know, have you ever had a misdemeanor or felony? No, it's only a crime when people break that restraining order and don't follow it, right?
It's like a very small slap on the wrist.
It's just on your file. So why not do it? And I understand it's a slippery slope when people have children together or live in the same home. I get all the arguments, but I just wish more was done and that harassment was taken a lot more seriously. Because we always say in these cases, hindsight is 20/20, and there was more that could have been done to protect her and many others from the second that she, like you said, very bravely came forward, because it is brave. I can tell you from my own experience, it is humiliating to share such intimate details of your life with a police officer and then again in court with a judge when you're pursuing a restraining order. But instead of just putting this on a file, documenting this, to try to protect her, to try to protect maybe future partners of his, and begin a record of this type of behavior, they thought a phone call would suffice. Had the officer before this taken this more seriously, maybe when Molly came forward, there would already have been a documented history on his file. Again, it's not a crime unless you break the restraining order. So what is the harm of giving these young girls some semblance of protection and creating a pattern so that when Molly walked in, they would already have it documented, and that would alert police officers, wow, this is a history of abuse. I need to take this more seriously. And then Molly would have the opportunity to be more informed and even more hyper-vigilant about her own safety. And it's just, clearly I'm passionate about this, but it's just such a disservice.
It is. The fact that, like, he was going to be fine. It's just going to be a little note in his record. And to your point, yeah, it probably would have helped Molly.
Absolutely. And it would have alerted the police. Like, okay, we see that this is becoming a pattern. Maybe we didn't do a restraining order with the last girl, but we can't just keep telling him, oh, I'm going to leave you a voicemail and tell you to stop, because he's not stopping. So
no,
now
he's
we need
0 for
to take
2.
It. Yeah. No, this
Those
is
not
3
good
now.
0 for 3. Jeez.
Yeah. So he had the girl that he went on one date with, and then the girl that he spit on and sent harassing messages to that he was with for just a short time. So that is why I say, please, if you're going to go through this, advocate for yourself. There are people who their literal job is to protect you. So if your gut is telling you that there's more to be done, then research your options, talk to a lawyer, keep records of everything. But please don't back down, because without them pulling up a file with a history, you can see how like this kind of goes dismissed. It looks to them like this is his first incident. I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to calm down a little bit. Let's get back to this phone call. The officer calls Josh on speakerphone. And just keep in mind, Molly's mom is sitting there listening to this. Molly is listening to this. And at the end of this call, the officer asks, or I guess really says quite sternly to Josh, "We aren't going to have to talk about this again, are we?" And Josh, in a monotone voice, chillingly replies, "Aren't we?"
Oh, I seriously got goosebumps. To say that to a police officer, this kid has no boundaries.
Why do you think he has the balls to say that to a police officer?
Because he's gotten away with it.
Ding, ding, ding. Obviously, you all know my opinion on what should have been done at this point, when he is clearly used to getting away with this type of behavior and is responding so combatively to this police officer. Like, I would never. I'd be like, "Yes, sir, I'm so sorry.
Same. I'd probably start crying. Like,
yeah, I'm going to church. I'm repenting. I'm never, ever, ever." Well, first, I'd never do any of this. But still, like, I would be scared shitless. And he has the audacity to respond that way. But when the police don't take action, mommy will, right? And Molly's mom did take action. Molly was home, like I said, for summer break. So her mom printed out pictures of Josh and handed them out to all of their neighbors, instructing them to call her if they ever saw him in the area. Go, mom.
What a great mom. And I'm sure Molly felt so supportive. I got Mama Bear on my side. She probably felt for once a little bit more safe, just knowing that her neighbors were alerted. His face is out there. Ugh, I love her mom. I want to hug her.
And this isn't something I would have thought of doing, but it's a great idea. Because if you're at work and your neighbor, Pam, I'm giving her the name Pam, I'm not sure, is sitting out drinking her lemonade and she sees the same car going by, she has this little document with his picture, his car. She knows exactly what to look out for. Like, this is where nosy neighbors can be very helpful.
We all have a nosy neighbor. And I bet this nosy neighbor in her neighborhood was like, "I will help you." She had that photo plastered like by the front door. She's just sipping her tea waiting for her moment.
Are you the nosy neighbor?
I might be.
Yeah,
I have
me
a lot
too.
Of security cameras.
This is what happens when you have a true crime podcast. You become the nosy neighbor. You're like terrified of online dating. Basically, I will become a hermit crab. So Josh, in his arrogant, I'm not going to use the word narcissist because I can't diagnose someone, but in his arrogance, he actually showed up himself to the police station the next day, saying that he was worried about his reputation, that rumors were flying that, you know, the police were involved. I mean, the absolute audacity.
You see my face right now.
I do.
Like, he did that.
Be permanent. You're going to have to Botox this look that you're giving me out, because we both have a very just like dumbfounded look on our face. The police advised Josh to delete Molly from all social media accounts and just leave her the hell alone. And this would, you know, all die down. On June 25th, Molly again contacted the police department because while Josh had followed their advice and blocked Molly as she had already done him, he kept posting offensive things about her online. Molly had heard about these and was obviously sent screenshots of these posts from others. Now, the person answering her phone call to the police station, I don't really know the process in the UK, so I don't know if this was a secretary of sorts or another police officer that answered the call, but they decided to just note this down and have the original officer Molly had spoken to handle this. The problem here is that that officer was off duty and planned to be out of office for a few days.
Oh my gosh, I can't.
Yeah. 2 days later on the 27th, the officer returns to work and sees Molly's new report. He contacts Molly and she tells him that Josh is now posting things on Facebook like, "I was cleared by the police and nothing further is going to happen." He's involving everyone in this nonsensical bullshit of his.
I have a question. Obviously, Josh has friends and family on Facebook. Did you ever see anything where his family was like, "You've got to stop"?
It sounds like he grew up with just his dad. And I think it took quite a while for my dad to join Facebook. I'm thinking around this time, it was still fairly new. Remember, Facebook originally was for like college students only.
Yeah. And
you had to use your .edu to even sign in.
That's a good point.
I don't know. It does say that he tagged her family in it, but that could be, you know, maybe they had social media, his parents didn't. But either way, I never saw that come up. But clearly, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt because they did take him to counseling and got him diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to just let his parents have a pass here because I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
The officer again calls Josh, tells him to delete all the posts, which he did, and then called back Molly to tell her that, "Hey, posts have been deleted. And now here's where I wish this story ended, as I always do with every case. Josh got intense therapy, Molly went on with college, and now is the biggest fitness blog influencer in the world. But fortunately, we're on this podcast, so this is not where the story ends. The same day that the police contacted Josh to remove those posts, what they didn't know is that Josh had left work early that day and had driven to, I believe it's Asda, which is a British supermarket chain, and had bought a knife and later returned to buy a pickaxe. And I have to be honest, of course I've heard of a pickaxe before, but I never really knew what they were. So if you're with me and you don't know diddly squat about tools, think of it like a hammer, but instead of the hammer end where you would hit a nail in, this part is a long metal or fiberglass kind of like stake that's curved to a point. These are used and made to be strong enough to break up rocks or dig into the ground. I'm going to leave you with that thought. Josh had used Tinder to match with another girl named Amy and manipulated this girl into adding Molly to social media and reporting back to him.
I am speechless. Oh my gosh.
It gets worse. While proof of how he did this isn't available online, it was implied that he told her about Molly's mental health, saying he was worried about his ex and her crazy behavior and just wanted to make sure she was okay. So this girl, and I want to give her the tiniest benefit of the doubt, the absolute tiniest, began to report back to him about what Molly was posting. But what makes me not want to give her any credit whatsoever is that she continued to keep him up to date on everything Molly was posting and even instructed him how he could view her Snapchat stories without her even knowing, and kept praising herself as like a super social media spy for him and all of this. She is a young girl. I don't get it, but Josh is still the perpetrator of all this. But you can tell, like, he must have been quite charming to manipulate someone into like basically becoming part of his little stalking harem and stalking a girl that she doesn't even know.
I've never heard of someone basically recruiting a person off Tinder to fill him in. Like, it's scary whenever you hear things like this. And he's, what, 24? He's not that old.
26.
26, yeah. He's not old. And to already have this mindset of like, I'm going to go on Tinder, get this girl to kind of like me, manipulate the situation, make me look like the good guy. It's an odd brain process he has going on.
Yeah. You know, I've always said when like men or girls are friends with their ex, maybe not super close, but on friendly terms, huge green flag. If you hear the word, my ex is so crazy, start doing some research. Okay. That's my little dating hint to you all that I've learned over the course of dating.
100%.
On June 28th, and you guys, I keep pointing out the dates because I want to show how quickly this escalated. So on June 28th, the day after he had scammed another girl into his web, tried to downplay things with police, and is out buying weapons, he got even more emboldened. Molly is gearing up for a fun night out with her girlfriends, probably much needed girls' night out, to be honest. It was a night for celebrating. She had gotten into a physical therapy course, huge accomplishment for her, and one of their other friends had received a promotion at work. So as we tend to do in the age of social media, Molly posted a gorgeous selfie online with the caption, "Ship and Trade this evening," with a little heart emoji. Ship and Trade was the name of the pub they're going to. Again, Molly thinks that Josh can't see any of her posts, or I doubt she'd be posting where she was going to be that evening. But all of her posts were being relayed without her knowledge by Amy to Josh. As the girls are enjoying their dinner, who walks by their table with a beautiful girl on his arm?
Josh.
Of course.
This guy, I can't get over him. Ugh.
Of course, her girlfriends felt terrible for her, right? You'd be like, are you kidding me with this guy? They are not thinking that, they're thinking that this is a coincidence, right? They're kind of like, well, he doesn't have her social media. What are the odds of him coming here? And on the night that you're out celebrating, and now poor Molly, you have to see him with another girl. But Molly, being the badass she was, responded to her concerned friends with, you know, I'm actually not jealous. And that's how I know I just don't love him anymore.
Good for her.
Absolutely. So she was done. At some point during dinner, Molly went up to the bar to find out where to pay for her parking and can feel Josh's eyes on her from the end of the bar. And when she looked up, He is smiling at her. Do you remember last episode where I said there's like a smile behind this fury? That's kind of what I picture here. It's not a smile that is generous and open and like, hey, I hope you're doing well. Sorry about my behavior. It's got you.
I picture that purple guy off Monsters, Inc. with the really big evil smile. Like, that's what I picture him sitting there like, haha, just like poking at her.
You're going to be such a good mom if your frame of reference is already Monsters, Inc. I think it might be slightly more sinister than that, but I do know the lizard guy you're talking about. The girls wrapped up dinner and Molly told her friends that she wanted to go home and watch Love Island, which same girl. The friends stayed to have a couple more drinks and Molly heads to her car to go home. The next morning on the 29th of June, Molly wakes up early to head to the gym to get her workout in. She headed there around 10 a.m. thinking that on this Thursday morning, she can record her workout video for a fitness blog while the gym is, you know, a little bit more empty. Most people are probably at work, presumably. What she doesn't know is Josh has been following her. He pulls into the gym parking lot just minutes after her. Now, when I am saying that he followed her from the past evening, that is a bit of a speculation, but he had this girl on this pseudo date. He wasn't interested in this poor girl. They hung out for a bit, and it seems like, although it's not proven, that when that girl left his home that evening, he then was on the hunt for Molly.
And that tracks with his past record of randomly showing up wherever she is, so it makes sense.
In CCTV footage from this gym, you can see Josh climbing the stairs to the upper level of the gym where Molly is. He's in a white tank top and gym shorts, and you can see him pause at the top of the stairs. He takes a big swig of water and then seemingly changes his mind and walks back down the stairs. But halfway down, he turns and comes back up, entering the room Molly is in. I just had Annie watch this, and we're going to put this on Instagram, but something that I noticed when watching this video is the difference even in his body language from the first time he comes up the steps. He seems kind of like slow moving. And then after he turns, he takes that sip of water and steals himself, it seems. And the second time he is sure-footed. He's taking the steps two at a time. The half second pause is where a decision was made, in my opinion. It's like a switch went off. It is very weird to watch. Again, we'll put this on Instagram and I want to see if you guys agree. Or maybe I'm just reading too much into this, but there is a clear, at least to me, difference in his body language.
Absolutely. The first time he comes up the stairs, it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to go do this workout, but I'm going to because I want to feel good. And then he goes back down. You just see like this turn and then it's boom, charging forward. I'm ready for my workout. I'm assuming he wasn't ready for a workout, but I totally agree with the difference is odd.
And I know how this story ends. So the way that I'm perceiving this is not that he was, I'm tired and I don't want to work out. There was a different decision made when he reached that halfway point, going back down the stairs and then returns. If you guys aren't driving, this might be a good time to look at Instagram at the video that we are going to be posting what the next CCTV camera shows. But if you are driving or you can't look right now, I'm going to let Annie watch it and then I'm going to have her describe what she sees to you.
So she's kind of in a part of the gym that is empty, and it's kind of one of those rooms where you go to stretch. She's doing her jumping plank, so he walks right next to her. In an empty room. Puts his mat down, starts doing some kind of crunching motion, and it takes her a second to realize that he's there. Once she does, she kind of pops up, and then she actually walks over to him and says something. They have some kind of conversation. He's still doing his crunching motion. And then she kind of walks back and then he leaves the gym area. But what stood out to me was that they're completely alone up there.
There's absolutely, let's say that we didn't know this history and we thought he was innocently going for a workout. Given the fact that police have already told him to stay away from her, there's no need for him to go. That was an intimidation thing. It's very clear to recognize that. But because of Molly's good group of friends, we actually have a little bit more insight to what was happening in that room that we couldn't hear. So Molly was recording her video, right? She makes these videos, she posts it to her blog. So she actually captured Josh on that video and she took a screenshot of it and sent it to her friend Amy and said, WTF, he's just turned up and come right next to me. Amy, who isn't around, they're all home for, you know, summer break. She is incredibly alarmed. And I want to read the text exchange between these two girls because I think it gives a sneak peek into exactly how Molly was feeling that day. At 10:59 a.m., Molly sent the photo of Stimson, that's Josh, with the words, WTF, he's just turned up and come right next to me. Amy responds, did you Snapchat that you were there? At 11 a.m., no, I literally haven't put anything. Amy responds, no indication you could have been there at all last night and now today. This is starting to look dodgy. He does know your routine, though, like you go early. Has he tried to speak with you? Molly goes on to explain that his arrival was on video as she had been recording herself exercising for her university course. At 11 a.m., I mean, these girls are furiously typing. They have gone through this much conversation in 1 minute. Molly says, I asked him why he wasn't at work, and he said it was none of my business. Amy responds, don't speak to him. At 11:01, I have left now. So all that you watched was in like a minute and a half. She confronts him. She decides that she's going to leave. Amy responds, don't initiate any contact at all. And Molly said, I won't from now on. Still at 11:01, these girls are like fingers of fury messing each other back and forth. Amy repeated her request for Molly not to communicate with Stimson, and Molly assured her that she wouldn't. At 11:02, Amy wrote, he has no sense of what is normal. He is a freak. Just stay away from him. Molly responded, I feel like I am expletive looking over my shoulder all the time. Molly also, clearly texting in a panic, wrote her mother what was going on, and her mom instructed her to leave and come straight home. At 11:02, Amy would write Molly, you posted where you were last night and now he's turned up. Just be careful. Who knows what? Has he always been a member of your gym? Sadly, that message would go unread. Molly left Pure Gym at 11:01 a.m., as indicated in her text messages. She headed out of the gym, thinking that Josh had already left, or maybe he was still upstairs, but she was leaving. What she didn't know is he was following her. He had parked in an aisle adjacent to where she was parked. I actually showed Annie a diagram. He parked very, very close to her.
Very close. He obviously knew that was her car. And then looking at the route that she takes, I mean, he's waiting for her, it looks like, unless he was directly behind her. But yeah, in terms of where their cars were parked, I don't think you can get like any closer than what
he's parked. They would have to be right next to each other. Mm-hmm. As Molly got into her car, Josh rushed over, pulled open her driver's side door, and began stabbing her repeatedly with a knife that he had purchased just 2 days before. A man named Ben Morton, who, big round of applause goes to, had just dropped off his wife at the movie theater that was in the same parking lot and had parked his car close to the gym to take his dog for a walk. Very cute and wholesome afternoon, or morning, I guess. He was in his car getting his playlist ready for their walk when he heard what he thought was an argument. I'm going to read directly his account of what he saw that morning. There seemed to be a fight going on. A man appeared to be hitting a woman. I stepped forward from the walkway, and at that point, I could see it was not just a fight, but a woman was seemingly getting attacked by the man. He seemed to have something in his hand. She was up at that point resisting. He was using both his hands. She had her hands up to try and stop him. I moved closer. I gave my dog to someone. Then I moved even closer to the car where I could see the man was attacking her with a knife or some kind of implement. It was quite small. There was already blood inside the car. When I got right in front of the car, I could see he was stabbing her. She was still trying to defend herself at that point. He was stabbing her towards her head and neck. It was something I've never seen and hopefully never will again. To be honest, I didn't know what to do. I shouted at people to say he was killing her and to call the police. I banged on the window of the car. I thought it might distract him. I was banging on the bonnet or the hood of the car. I was hoping the police might arrive. Someone might arrive with some idea of what to do. It is not something you expect to find in a car park. I shouted and I said, he's killing her. I kept shouting, stop killing her, but he wouldn't stop. The attack just carried on. She was still trying to protect herself to start with, but it was obvious she was getting weaker. No one else was coming, so I thought I should try and do something. I moved to the driver's side where he was leaning across and attacking her. I could see his leg was sticking out of the door. I tried to slam the door on his leg to distract him. He moved his leg inside the car and just carried on. I moved around and grabbed his leg with my hands to see if I could pull him from the car. His leg was so covered in blood at this stage that my hand kept slipping off. At that point, I stepped back. I didn't know what else to do. I could see inside the car. I could see her throat had been slit. He seemed determined to make sure she was dead. He just kept stabbing her. When he realized he could do no more, he drove his car over to block in Molly's to prevent Josh from getting away. When the police arrived at the scene, Josh was calmly standing by Molly's vehicle, completely soaked in blood. And there's actually a video, but I'm not going to show it because you can see the blood. His demeanor in this police body cam video is just so incredibly strange, because it's like, what? Like, he calmly walks over to the car, he puts his hands on the hood of the police car, gets arrested, obviously, on site. It's just eerie how calm he was after such a frenzied attack. In just minutes, Molly had suffered around 75 wounds, different cuts and slashes across her body, including a very serious and critical slash to her throat. Molly McLaren died at the scene.
I have like tears in my eyes because, first, you've done such a good job about describing Molly. Like, I adore her. And then hearing how she died and how scared she was leading up to her death and the horrific manner that she was murdered. Like, I have a pit in my stomach right now.
You know, I don't normally want to go into too graphic of detail, but I think in this, to understand that this is minutes and what a frenzied attack that would be to inflict 75 wounds. Why, there is a grown man, and I've looked up pictures of this hero, and, you know, he tried his best to stop this, even though I'm sure he was absolutely scared out of his mind witnessing this. And this man is soaked in blood, and it's like he just can't be stopped. He gets his leg slammed in the door, doesn't even pause, it seems like. He just pulls his leg back in and continues on. Like, how do people have so much fury in them that would even allow their body to do that? And like you said, he wasn't distracted by anything, not even this man coming towards him.
Terrifying.
Who's like twice his size. He didn't even care.
And poor Ben yelling out, like, she's dying, someone help me. Like, he really is an amazing good Samaritan.
Yeah.
But also just to be in Molly's position and be like, someone's trying to help. I mean, it's just the whole situation is heartbreaking. And the fact that it happened so quickly.
It's unbelievable.
That's more than a stab a second. I mean, he's really, like, yeah. Ben mentioned in his recount of the situation, he was determined to make sure that she died.
It's unbelievable. And his demeanor in the body cam footage, like I said, I don't think we'll be sharing that because it's a little bit too gruesome. But just take my word for it. It is so odd how calm and satisfied with himself he looks. It's like the scene, like true evil. Josh said he wanted to plead guilty to manslaughter, not murder, on the grounds of diminished responsibility on the basis of an abnormality of functioning arising from his mental condition. However, a community psychiatric nurse who spoke with him said he showed absolutely no overt symptoms of psychosis or acute mood disorders. He told, I think at one point, he told people that he was bipolar. He had never been diagnosed with bipolar. And quite frankly, just because you have a personality disorder does not mean that you would or are even capable of doing this. So it just kind of pissed me off that he leaned on this. But the jury saw all the evidence. His ex-partners even testified, describing their harassing and abusive relationships. And in the end, it only took the jury 4 hours of deliberating to convict Josh of murder. The judge decided to sentence him the very same day, saying, "This was a cruel, calculated, and cowardly act. This was an act of wickedness. You took away Molly's life quite deliberately in the most vicious of fashion. You were determined to punish her for ending the relationship with you. You were seeking revenge. She was a 23-year-old, beautiful, and intelligent girl. Her family's grief and anguish is raw and apparent for everyone to see. You are a highly dangerous young man, and you will pose a very considerable risk to women for a very considerable period in the future." And with that, on the same day that he was convicted, she sentenced 26-year-old Joshua Stimson to life in prison with a minimum of 26 years.
I know the UK has different laws, but he couldn't have gotten life without parole. I know Canada has kind of a different outlook on how long someone can be locked up. At least she sentenced him that day, got him off the streets, because who knows?
Well, it's just kind of unheard of to be sentenced the same day.
Yeah.
Normally, like, you get convicted, you go back to jail and await a sentencing. She wasn't having any of it. It's like, nope, get him exactly where he belongs. After the trial, of course, the Staffordshire Police Force came under questioning. In 2017, after Molly's death, they did introduce a GPS personal device given to vulnerable victims that sort of acts as a silent safety alarm, and it calls 999 silently, and that's their version of 911, which is a great idea. There was also an internal review of the case, and in that report about how police handle harassment and stalking, The reviewer wrote something I think is very important for all of us to understand, and what my message has very much been, but not so eloquently, throughout this series. And it goes like this. The end of a relationship can be an event that results in the start of escalation or domestic abuse, stalking, and harassment. Separation may not be the solution to domestic abuse. It may increase the risk to the victim. Physical violence is not the only precursor to domestic homicide. Molly's death confirms that physical violence is only one indicator of the risk of domestic homicide. After their relationship ended, Stimson attempted to coerce and control her using social media. It is therefore important that all indicators of potential serious harm are identified. Social media has become a method of stalking and harassment, which can result in coercion and control even if the victim and perpetrator do not meet or speak to each other. Professionals should treat cases of stalking and harassment by social media as seriously as those that involve direct contact between the parties. Molly McLaren was a stunning 23-year-old who had turned her dark times into a catalyst for change, not only in her life, but in her pursuit of a career to help others. And in her honor, the Molly McLaren Foundation was started by her parents to continue that legacy, offering services and resources for those suffering from eating disorders. This case broke my heart to research, but I don't want to end this series telling you about these sad stories without giving you some resources and just more understanding about this type of abuse that quite often goes unreported, or at least underreported. In the next episode in this series, we are having Dr. Kirk Honda, a psychotherapist and professor better known online as Psychology in Seattle, in his podcast and YouTube series. Honestly, y'all, check out his series on YouTube. He watches reality TV shows like 90 Day Fiancé. I think he even covered a few episodes of The Bachelor. And while that sounds kind of funny and like, what does that have to do with psychology? He uses clips from those shows to talk about communication and attachment styles and relationships. He is incredible. I have learned so much from his YouTube series. I feel like I am a more effective communicator now in times of like conflict because of watching it. And I love the perspective he has. And he's going to be joining us to answer the questions that many of you submitted on our Instagram. And I really cannot wait to talk to him. I've been a fan of his for years, and I think he is going to provide not only a lot of insight, but a more professional and educated way to look at this.
I'm so excited to have him on. And also thank you to everyone who submitted a question. They were really sad because, you know, some of you guys are in these really tough positions and my heart goes out to you, but do appreciate giving us some questions to ask him and he'll answer them. You guys
a lot that I didn't even think about. So I really look forward to that discussion. This series was going to be 3 parts. It now looks like it's going to be 4. But I want to ask and end this with, if you are someone that resonates with anything we discussed today, maybe you're recognizing these patterns in your relationship, as always, we're going to encourage you to check out www.thehotline.org or call or text 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233, where you can speak with a professional and find resources for creating a safety plan for leaving the relationship. That was a tough one.
That was. This whole series is tough, but I'm coming back next episode with one of the cases. Elise, you and I both have the question asked, what's the one episode that has always stuck with you? And I'm covering one of the two that have always stuck with me. It's about a cruise. Foreshadowing.
Boy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if my little heart could take it, because last time I covered one of the two cases that's always stuck with me, it was Sylvia Likens. And I was crying.
I was crying.
And having nightmares for a week.
Yeah, it was rough.
Well, be prepared for that. I was going to say Annie's going to give us a little break between episodes, but clearly not. So we will be back next Sunday as Annie covers probably an absolutely horrible case. But as always, until then.